Misty sunrise in my hometown, rows of cotton about knee high. Mrs. Baker down the dirt road, still got clothes out on the line. Irwin Nichols there with Judge Lee, playing checkers at the gym. When I dream about...
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Packers Podcast. My name is Michael Cohen and I'm here as always with fellow beat reporter Bob McGinn. Our podcast is brought to you by Cannon and Dunphy, and we appreciate their support. It is Wednesday morning, 11 a.m. at the McGinn headquarters, just west of Lambeau Field. It's actually a little bit warmer than it's been, Bob. Some of that ice on your driveway is finally melting. How's it going?
Heat wave, Mike.
I know. 36 on the way over. I was stunned.
Pat and I went for a walk last night about 10:30, and what normally would be a 45-minute walk took about an hour and 15. We're just like...
Because of the ice.
Penguins going down the street.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
Well, she bailed on you last week. It was too icy.
Yeah. She tucked tail and went right back in the house.
So we got back, pretty early, Monday morning. That was one of those brutal flights where we left the hotel for the airport at like 3 a.m. And now we're back, and we'll do it all again this weekend in Atlanta. But before we jump into that and the recap of the Dallas game, let's talk about the musical selection. What did you dig up this week, Bob? I didn't know this one, the artist or the song.
This is Mr. Buddy Jewell, J-E-W-E-L-L, okay?
Okay.
And he's a Southerner, and so we're going down south, Mike, so might be appropriate. Buddy sang this in 1993. I think he was a guy off of Country Sound Search or some TV show like that. But Pat and I saw Buddy at Country Fest in Nashville about 5 years ago. Just for the heck of it, we went down there on the Durango stage. And Buddy now owns a bagel shop in Nashville. So he came over for a little half-hour gig on this small stage, all right? Now, Sweet Southern Comfort's the song. And smelling about jasmine and magnolia and sleepy sweet home Alabama and Roll Tide Roll and Blessed Graceland, Mike, right down in your former neck of the woods,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Memphis, yep.
Down home Dixie, Yellow Rose of San Antone, get back to the jasmine and magnolia. Now, I don't know anything about the South. I really don't, okay? I've never set foot in Mississippi, I don't think.
Okay.
Hardly ever in Alabama. This is one of probably like two or three songs in my life that when I hear this song, tears come to my eyes. It's just the weirdest thing.
Yeah, that's
these
weird.
Words and these sounds of this Dixie, this description. And I was looking at this, I printed out the lyrics here last night. And I was looking at comments. And the second commenter, this woman said the exact same thing. She starts weeping when she hears this song.
Well, the key word
so it's
there,
not just me.
Well, the key word there is woman.
All right. I'm putting myself out there on this one. But I think it's a heck of a song, and I hope somebody out there agrees with me.
I'm sure somebody will. On a tangential note, have you ever drank Southern Comfort, Bob?
Not once or twice.
It's not great.
No?
Okay. A little strong for my taste.
Yeah. Buddy Jewell, what do you think of the song, Mike?
As I've said on this many times, I'm not a country guy, but I will admit the descriptive lines in there are pretty good. Pretty good.
We've got to interject a little country now and then.
If you say so.
Every 10th week, maybe?
I'll leave those to you. All right, so the Dallas game. It was a thrilling game. For the second year in a row, we saw a playoff game that went right down to the wire. Just really exciting plays, finished out by a field goal this time by Mason Crosby, whereas last year the Packers were obviously on the other end in the desert after Larry Fitzgerald ran and ran and ran and then took a little shovel pass in to knock the Packers out of the playoffs. So first of all, I mean, you've seen tons and tons of playoff games. The way this fourth quarter played out, one of the more exciting finishes you've seen in a little while?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. It looked like Dallas was out of it, and then they got back in, and then it kind of seemed like they were going to score a touchdown on their final possession. They were almost unstoppable, and Green Bay made one play, the deflection by Perry at the simultaneous, the quarterback hit by Clay Matthews, and the field goal by Bailey, and that gave Green Bay time to come back down the field. All right, so a touchback on the kickoff by Bailey. Green Bay's got the ball on the 25, 35 seconds left and two timeouts, okay? He threw a good ball down to Jared Cook on a seamer, against Byron Jones. Do you think Cook should have caught that ball? Is that a drop?
I kind of thought Jones got, maybe he didn't touch the ball, but I thought maybe he waved a hand right in front of Cook's sight line. Now, I'm not saying that's an excuse not to catch it, but I don't think it was as if it was a clean drop with no interference there. Should he catch that ball? Honestly, I'm going to say no. I didn't view it as a drop. What did you think?
Well, I still got to make my decision on that for the archives and for the final season stats. I got to go back and look at it on the All 22. I'm just not sure. All right, so then, you know, Mike McCarthy is great on starting these end of game or 2 minute end of half situations with a drive starter. Well, now it's second and 10, but he goes back to a drive starter. He calls the screen to Ty Montgomery. It was really a great call, 17 yards.
It really was, and that's something that we've seen a lot of variations of with Montgomery. We've seen like a traditional screen where Rodgers throws it overhand. We've seen the little shovel pass inside that sets up the screen. And so they found different ways to accomplish the same concept without necessarily providing the exact same look every time. And I don't think they'd used that at all in the game up until that point, had they?
No, I don't think so.
So this was a brand new call brought out late in the game, just like in Arizona last year when Arians brought out that shovel pass. They hadn't shown anything like that at all until overtime, and it just completely catches the defense by surprise when you see a brand new look.
And Montgomery got out of bounds, 23 seconds left. They're at their own 42. All right, so now Rod Marinelli's up in a blitz look. He had been playing real soft the first two snaps, and old Rod comes with a it was in a 3-2 look, and he sent guys from each side, and the right one was picked up, and Heath, what's his first name?
Jeff.
Yep, Jeff Heath comes off the left side. Montgomery has got a two-way look there, I think, and he made a late lunge. He's not quite experienced enough to get him, and Heath comes in from the backside, and he ripped number 12, right, Mike?
Now, I will say this. When I went back and I watched the tape on the NFL Game Pass thing that we have, which is a subscription to all the different games, the hit did not look as vicious to me as it did when I watched it in the press box and on the camera angles that they had on the big screen there. That's not to say it wasn't a big hit. It certainly was a blindside hit. But to me, it looked much more impactful live than when I saw it on tape. But you and I both agree, and you said it in the video you did with our colleague Pete Doherty after the game, the thing that might have impressed you the most about any play in that game was how he held on to that football. I know we've talked about this in the past, that Rodgers has told you that he believes every single fumble is avoidable regardless of the circumstances, and this would be one of those situations where I don't think a lot of people would have blamed him if he dropped that football, given the way the hit came in.
Agreed. You know, Mike, when he hits that the helmet in the back, right? Legal hit. As he's going down after absorbing the blow, that other hand, the left hand, is coming to the ball. You can see that on that tape. He is so technically superior right now in the pocket with those hands, and he wasn't earlier in the year when he was fumbling, and we were on him for that. But at this point, that other hand was coming there, and it helps him hold on to the football.
So his hand size is above average, right, for quarterbacks?
Yeah, I think it's 10 and an eighth or 10 and a quarter.
So let's say you go down to an average size hand for a quarterback. Is a guy much more likely to drop it? Does it make that much difference for Rodgers, do you think?
Slightly. I wonder what the average size hand for an NFL QB is. 9.5?
Okay.
I'd guess.
I was just amazed because, as you mentioned, you can see the left hand coming toward the ball, but there's a good couple hundredths of a second where he's only squeezing it in his right hand.
It's right.
As if a guy was palming a basketball. And to be able to have that much pressure, I guess, around the ball and hold on to it as your other hand comes toward it, I was stunned he didn't fumble.
So then, just on the, he's taking a shot. I mean, people, that just jars the heck out of you. Within a second, he's got presence of mind to look back at, who was the ref? Tony Corrente.
Yeah.
And signal for that timeout.
Before he even stood up.
Yes. He's on all fours, basically rolling around. That's the Packer he calls the second timeout. He's just on this. That only took 5 seconds. It's down to 18. All right, so now there's he just extends it. There's not much pressure on second down, and he just kind of moseys off to the right. And he throws a dart over there to Cook on the sideline in front of the Packer bench.
Mm-hmm.
And Byron Jones.
It was in front of the Cowboys bench,
okay.
I think, yeah.
Yep. Boy, the breakup by Byron Jones. Wow. Wasn't it something? Right on the sideline?
It was real impressive. I mean, that was a matchup, those two guys, all day long for the most part. And, you know, there were times where Cook got the better of him, but Jones also, I think, had two passes defensed, or maybe it was three even. He had one near the goal line for sure, and then he had that one late in the game. It was a decent battle between those two guys.
Yeah. That ball was 19 yards downfield, again, thrown on a dime, incomplete. Third and 20 at the 32 with 12 seconds left. All right, Marinelli rushes three. He's going back to that deal. And he figures, how many yards do the Packers need to have a field goal attempt? They'd attempt a 60-yard attempt, let's say.
Crosby said, I read somewhere that Crosby said his max indoors was 58, but that as the last drive was happening, I can't remember where I read this, that he went to Zook and said, give me a try if it's 61 or 60. Like, I think I can do it.
So they got to get 28 yards to the 40 for a 58-yard attempt. Okay. All right, Mike. So this is so what happens next?
So the ball is snapped, and Rodgers moves the pocket to the left. I think that was probably by design that he wanted to get outside, whether it was to one side or the other. They went to the left. You know, and maybe that's not the side that you would expect him to go, being a right-handed quarterback, going to his left to throw back across his body. Cook runs a crossing route in this against this zone defense that the Cowboys had, where he was probably maybe 3 or 4 yards behind Byron Jones, and then probably 7 or 8 yards, I would say, in front of the next defender that was deeper. And I don't know if Byron Jones didn't think the throw was coming, or maybe he was looking at Cook and didn't see Rodgers release it. But for whatever reason, I thought he kind of slowed down as he got to the sideline, almost as if he was watching the ball as it came toward Cook. I don't know if he could have gotten there to deflect it, but I did think that it was a little surprising, the lack of drive he showed toward the end of that play to try and get there. Cook makes a tremendous catch where I think he gets, you know, like 1 foot down and one ankle down. His other foot was kind of turned on its side there. They make the catch. It's reviewed, and it sets up Crosby from 52. Right? 51 or 52? 51 with 3 seconds left. What did you think of that play?
Well, let me mention this one thing. You know, we're writing on deadline, and in my game story the next day, that night, I wrote that it was a tight spiral. Okay, so then for posterity's sake, as a being a paper of record and a writer of record, when I looked at the tape on Monday, it was a wobbly ball.
It was.
Whatever it was. Yeah. I just used the word wobbly to be accurately describe what happened. So a couple emailers now have ripped me for as if I was criticizing Rodgers for throwing a wobbly pass. Give me a break. This is a fantastic pass. I don't care if it was end over end. It got there beautifully, so I just want to make that clear, all right?
A wobbly ball can still be accurate.
Of
I mean,
course.
How many tight spirals does Eli Manning throw?
That doesn't Peyton mean, Manning.
Yeah, that doesn't mean every throw is inaccurate.
So, okay, that was not – all right. So, all right, the catch by Cook – the spatial awareness,
yeah,
everything, unreal. So who wrote that he had size 16 feet?
Not me.
Tom did that.
Okay,
that was pretty good detail, wasn't it?
It's not bad.
Tom Silverstein, our illustrious colleague. Okay, so now Crosby's up. Dallas calls their third timeout just as he drills the first one. He really hit that, didn't he?
Yeah, he hit the first one really, really well.
Okay, so now there's a 30-second break, and Crosby just kind of goes off the back there and gathers himself and reloads. The second one, how much did it make it by?
I think it got more and more central as the kick went on. Mm-hmm. And I think at its worst, it might have been at the goalpost or maybe just to the outside of it. He snuck it back in with a little bit of a fade for a right-footed kicker, and I would say when it cleared the uprights, it was 4 feet, 5 feet inside, no more than 2-3 yards at most.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those screwballs that he's hit recently that he's missed wide right.
It's been weird, too, because he's really only had the issue with the strange ball flight, I feel like, on long kicks. And I don't know if it's because he's swinging too hard. And I don't necessarily mean 50-yarders. I mean, like, over 40. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen him hit any short ones that have been real ugly, except that PAT in Detroit. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. That was a screwball outside,
right.
Yeah.
But he's had a couple this year on longer kicks that have just been very strange ball flights. And like I said, I don't know if it's because he's swinging too hard or what it is, but the snap and the hold look good on that.
Yep. All right, so what else do we want to talk about on this game, Mike?
So we went through basically what won it for the Packers, but on the other side of things, when I was reading through the quote sheets from the Dallas locker room, it was completely the opposite. It was not necessarily that they gave up you know, this field goal at the end. It was that they couldn't convert that third down. So let's talk a little bit about that Dallas drive. You've got your notes here. Where did they start?
They started on their own 25 after Crosby's 56-yarder.
Okay, and right away on first down, they have a huge gain almost to midfield, right?
Terrence Williams over there working against Hawkins for 24 right. on a dig, right?
And as is the case in many games, the Packers front office was sitting behind us. So I don't know exactly who said this, but somebody from behind them said, it's first down and we already let them get to midfield or something like that. Or they're already at the 50 after first down. I can't believe it. And from there, I mean, you had to think that they were, you know, with the way they were playing in that fourth quarter, you had to bet that they were going to score a touchdown.
They're letting the clock run. There's 107 left. I mean, they're trying to shorten it for Green Bay, you know. Throws one to Witten for 11 against Hyde right in the middle, hugs the ball. Now, here he goes up and spikes the ball, which is a bit of a controversial act, I guess.
I don't know. Maybe I'm missing something. I don't understand why it was controversial. Was it just because it left too much time or?
Just removed a down.
Oh, okay.
You know?
All right. So they could have called timeout is what people were saying.
Yeah.
All right, I got you.
So then, okay, then he... then Dom Capers, he does not sit on his hands. He blitzed six, Mike, for only the third time all day.
Yeah, I got a couple emails about that.
He's going to go down fighting.
There's no doubt about it. He's not going to, especially, I mean, that was second down, but on third down, late in the game, he's not going to sit there and rush three or four.
Mm-hmm. He rushed five, in fact, on third down. Okay, they hit Beasley for seven on a little out over there against Demarius Randall. So it's third and three, out of bounds. And he's going to try to hit Bryant over the middle at about 12 yards.
Yeah, on the slant, yep, against Gunter.
And on the left side, there's a TE run by Dayton Jones goes first, and then Perry comes beneath him.
Right.
And Perry's stymied, but he jumps up beautifully, the way you're taught, textbook stuff. He jumps up and bats that ball as Clay Matthews stunts inside on the other side and beats Ron Leary for a knockdown.
Came in low, right?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. So that's third down. They're left with fourth down. Obviously, they kicked the field goal, 52 yards. Dan Bailey, another tremendous kicker. I think the thing that stood out to me about this drive was, in many ways, it highlighted a lot of the flaws and also the ability to hang on of this secondary. So let's kind of just talk about what this secondary was. Going into the game, you had Ladarius Gunter on one edge, Demarius Randall on the other, Micah Hyde, and Morgan Burnett in the slot for, you know, the dime when you have four corners in there, or four, you know, DBs in the front. Then they had Kentrell Bryce and HaHa Clinton Dix. So in the very first drive, Gunter and Burnett collide with each other as Gunter goes to deflect a pass intended for Bryant. And Burnett comes back a couple plays the next drive, but that quad injury keeps him out. So at that point, you know, given the experience of, or inexperience, I should say, of Bryce, the fact that they have to put Hawkins onto the field, how significant of a loss is Morgan Burnett in that type of situation? Now, I know they won the game, but just without him, how different is it?
Well, in the run defense, eh, Mike? You know? I mean, they're... You know, fortunately for the Packers, they got ahead, and that did kind of minimize the impact of Ezekiel Elliott. He had 22 for 125, right? But by rights, he probably should have had 30 carries or 35, and then they would have been in good shape. But they fell behind so far. Burnett's a major loss. People, scouts, assistant coaches really like this guy around the league, you know? He's deeply appreciated.
So without him, you know, Bryce is in there and Hawkins is in there. Hawkins didn't have to play a whole lot because they didn't play a ton of dime. He gave up, I think, one big catch on like an in route, kind of a deep in. And that wasn't necessarily a terrible play or anything. It's not like he got burned badly. But the two big issues that I identified, and we'll see if you agree, is that one, no matter how much they want to match Ladarius Gunter with these number one receivers, I just don't think it's going to work this weekend. And we can talk about that a little bit later in terms of why. But first, let's talk about Gunter versus Bryant. Now, there's no doubt about it. This is a mismatch on paper, and it's a mismatch on the field. Is Bryant a top 10 receiver in the league when he's healthy?
Yes.
Okay. Is Gunter a top 30 corner in the league?
So there's 64 starters and another. So there's 96 guys who play all the time?
Right. Is he top 30?
No.
Agreed. So you're talking about a serious mismatch. And, you know, the guy fights like heck. He's going to play physical at the line of scrimmage, just like he does with everybody. But the bottom line is that whether it was at the point of attack, whether it was the crispness of the routes, he couldn't keep up. And I think Bryant had 9 catches for 132 and 2 touchdowns. And as our colleague Tom Silverstein and I were discussing after the game, if you watch Gunter's body language after each catch, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, he just seemed to get more and more dejected. He got up from the sideline one time and was shaking his head. On that short play-action pass to Bryant for the touchdown, he ended up on his back, just kind of flat and looking at the sky. You almost felt bad for the guy a little bit.
That's an interesting observation, Mike.
And then when I talked to him in the locker room, you could tell that it was just as if every weight in the world was lifted off his shoulders, because he knew he was going to get blamed for a lot of that if they lost. And, you know, as I wrote in my story, Alonzo Highsmith, one of the personnel executives, comes over to Gunter right when I'm starting to interview him, puts his arm around Gunter and goes, "Gunter lives to fight another day. Ho, ho, Gunter lives to fight another day." And Gunter's just spent, completely exhausted. Then Joe Witt, the cornerback's coach, comes over. He consoles him for a little bit and basically says, "Hey, you know, I appreciate everything you're trying to do for us," and all that kind of stuff. And so the guy is busting his tail. He just doesn't have the skill to play that position. How have they survived with that against Beckham, against Bryant?
Mike, would you permit me to interject one
thing?
Go ahead. Wouldn't it have been nice to have interviewed Alonzo Highsmith and Joe Witt about this fabulous victory, the emotions of it at the end? I see Mike Turgovac walking through. No, under Mike McCarthy, all these assistant coaches are off limits.
Right, and the only reason I quoted Highsmith is because he said something that I could hear.
Many of their great victories over time, the Sterling Sharp ball at the Silver Dome in 93, on and on. I remember talking to assistant coaches, coordinators, out by the bus, all kinds of people, when the game of newspapers and the coverage of these teams by the NFL was a totally different thing. But it's really unfortunate. It's on the team. It's a shame. Okay.
So with Gunter playing as best he can, but giving up all those yards, and Demaryius Randall, I don't know what happened to him on the other side. What did you see when you watched the film with Randall?
It just wasn't very good. Non-competitive. I don't know. He's added to the injury report on Saturday with a foot injury. It's questionable, right? Again, it's hard to talk to people to find out, you know, what this injury is. He's had a whole series of injuries this year. But he was playing loose. He was playing somewhat, I don't know, nonchalant. You just can't really – well, they won, but you can't really – I don't know what you can't do anymore, but you wouldn't think you could win with that kind of performance out there, but they have.
The one thing that I noticed is that, and Troy Aikman actually mentioned it on the broadcast, he got turned around a couple times on routes, but I noticed that it was kind of the same way each time. It looked like Gunter was turning to the outside as if he was anticipating a lot of people trying to run deep on him, like he was going to have to open up his hips and go with somebody on like a fly pattern or a go route. And then when guys would cut inside, like on a slant or something, he would have to spin around and twist his hips the wrong way because he had opened toward the sideline. And so that happened at least 2 or 3 times against Terrence Williams. And I don't know if maybe that was a scouting report thing, that they thought they were going to take more shots or what, but he kept looking like he was trying to run deep with guys, and then they would cut inside of him, and it caused problems.
So we'll see if Quentin Rollins can play this week. If he does, I think he's going to be on the field quite a bit.
The one real feather in Gunter's cap that I wrote about, I'll just mention this real quickly, is that on that last drive where they could have given up a touchdown to lose the game, Bryant didn't have a catch.
No, he would have had one on the...
Exactly. But he didn't have one.
Deflection, right.
Okay, so let's talk about something else on the defense. You talked about Kenny Clark's performance in your rating the Packers. The rookie first-round pick from UCLA, his best game of the year?
Well, I'd have to go back and really think about that, Mike. I know there was one or two I wrote about and really liked. But this was a good one, and considering the opposition, you know, maybe it was. Three times. He had 25 or 26 snaps. Three times he got a two-hand jam into the chest of one on Travis Frederick, one on Zach Martin, and I think another one on Ronald Leary, I believe it was. These guys are really good players. Martin's as good as it gets, and Frederick pretty much is too. He was driving them back. The first third down when Dallas had to kick a field goal, that was because he drove Martin back right into Zach Prescott, Dak. So for Clark, you know, I kind of wrote before the game, the day of the game, that this was a litmus test for him and he'd been okay, but they need more than okay. Well, I thought they'd play a lot more 3-4. They only had, I think, 5 snaps of that. But as a pass rusher, which I didn't expect, he came through. very pleasant development for the Packers from a personnel front.
Yeah, he wasn't bad at all. And in the locker room after the game, he was pretty fired up. I talked to him. He said the whole D-line, they didn't necessarily mention this much during the week leading up to it, but they said they were really, really agitated and frustrated with all of the coverage being heaped on the offensive line for the Cowboys and Ezekiel Elliott and how good these guys are. And so, you know, by no means did they shut down Elliott and by no means did they shut down the Cowboys offense, but they wanted to go out there and show that this wasn't going to be, you know, the cakewalk that Dallas had the last time these two teams met in, what was it, week six? So that was kind of interesting to hear after the game. The last thing I think we wanted to touch on here is the premier pass rusher for each side. So let's start with Clay Matthews. He had that matchup with Tyron Smith, arguably the best left tackle in the league. As you wrote, I think it was a pretty one-sided affair. What did you make of that?
You know, they're both playing hurt. Clay Matthews with a shoulder, and Smith's got a bulging disc all year, and he's got a knee injury that knocked him out of the last, I don't know, game and a half or something. So I look at Matthews, and I chart every one of his rushes, and there was 28 non-stunt rushes. So when he stunts, and that's an automatic double team, so I'm not counting that. But there was 28 times when he was one-on-one against Smith, and 28 one-on-ones, and he had 25 against Smith. He got nothing against him. Smith is incredible, Mike. Incredible, isn't he? He just wipes people out. He comes off, he looks like he weighs about, he moves like he's 200 pounds, doesn't he?
Yeah.
It's just one of those dancing bears, Walter Jones, Jonathan Ogden, I mean, Willie Rolfe. It's incredible. And he just handled Clay. Clay tried, but he just got smothered.
So flip the script. How about David Irving for the Cowboys going against Bakhtiari for the most part, right?
Well, I think it's more Bulaga.
Oh,
and
that's
then
right.
The
that's
inside.
Right. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I got the sides mixed up there.
I started out, you know, you can't, when you're watching live, Mike, you can only look at one thing, really. And I was the first series I decided to watch Irving. I talked to a scout about this yesterday, and he was doing the same thing when he was watching the game on tape. And Irving was just nothing. He was just persona neuter, null and void, I guess. That'd be the best way to put it. What a job by Corey Linsley. He had a lot of snaps against Irving, Bulaga, and so did T.J. Lang. And it was a wipeout. Irving had no pressures. He was a non-factor completely. And that's when Marinelli saw that his four-man rush was going nowhere. That's when he started to send Orlando Scandrick and Heath.
All their sacks came from defensive backs, either corners or safeties off the edge.
He never rushed six. Old Rod played it pretty tight to the vest, but 36% on five-man rush.
Yeah, it was interesting to see. Two pretty darn good offensive lines. Anything else you want to talk about from the Dallas game?
No, we're supposed to be looking ahead, Mike.
We will. All right, we're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsor, and then we'll take a look at the Atlanta Falcons in the NFC title game.
At Cannon and Dunphy, we're proud of our winning reputation. We're also proud to be the exclusive sponsor of the excellent Journal Sentinel coverage of our great football team. I'm Bill Cannon. To learn more about our winning team, go to our website.
So as has been the case quite often this year, you've got an old newspaper clip for me to take a gander at here. This one relates to the Falcons and the last time they were in an NFC title game. What'd you find, Bob?
All right, Atlanta has been in three title games, Mike. 2012, they lost at home to the Niners, Jim Harbaugh's gang, 28-24. In 04, they went to Philly and lost to Andy Reid, 27-10. And in 98, Randy Moss's rookie year, they went to Minnesota, and the Dirty Birds won in overtime, 30-27. Our great columnist at the Milwaukee Journal, Mike Bauman, and I covered that game. That was shortly after Ray Rhodes had been hired by the Packers to replace Mike Holmgren. We sat in the auxiliary press box over in the corner and watched this drama play out, and it was drama. 64,000 at that Metrodome. The sound was amplified. They had these amplifiers. The place was, it was loud. It wasn't as loud as the Superdome that I've talked about with the Brett Favre playoff game about 7 years ago, but this was close. All right, the Vikings, they had a 27-17 lead with about 5 minutes left, and this thing goes into overtime. All right, Gary Anderson had made 39 in a row, the Vikings kicker. 39 in a row, including two in this game. And he had a 38-yarder. Now, when was this? I got to find out if this was overtime or when this was here, Mike. Excuse me, listeners. This was from 38 yards, a distance he had made longer than that 16 times. It had plenty of distance, but it had a slight hook, just enough to take it inches outside the left upright. Gary Anderson was 39 at the time. And then Morton Anderson, the veteran Falcon kicker, hit from 38 with only 3:08 left in OT. And Atlanta was in the Super Bowl against the Broncos. They played very poorly in that Super Bowl. So Atlanta was a 10.5-point underdog that day at the Metrodome. And it's a game that Minnesotans will never forget until they reach a Super Bowl, you know.
And they'll be a what, a 4.5-point favorite this weekend? Four and a half?
I was told 5.
Okay.
Yeah, last night I was told 5. So that's the Falcons' playoff history, and they're trying to win their first Super Bowl.
Let's take a look at the Falcons. It's been, what, week 8, I think, was when we were down there? Maybe? I can't remember at this point. It was a real exciting game, 33-32. The Falcons won. It was basically sort of what people are forecasting for this weekend. I read online that there were only, I think, like 6 combined scoring drives that didn't end in points the whole game. It was just back and forth with Rodgers and Matt Ryan putting up big, big numbers. And at the end, there was a little bit of a blown coverage by the Packers that ended up costing them. But before we get into any more details about the game, let's look at the personnel changes since the last meeting between these two.
Okay, on offense, there's not much change. There's one big one, really, and that's Tevin Coleman did not play against Green Bay with a hamstring. He was replaced by diminutive Teron Ward. Ward played okay. He's 5'6". He played pretty well in that game, relieving Devontae Freeman. But Coleman now is the real deal. Boy, in the last 4 games, Mike, total yards from scrimmage, Freeman and Coleman have 884. That's 221 a game.
Jeez.
48% of their offense. You know, they've gained in those 4 games. They got 1,845 yards. So Coleman is that second-round pick from Indiana 2 years ago, 2015. He's listed at 6'1". He's 5'11 and a half, about 210, 215. You know, he's not an elusive guy. He's a little bit like Ryan Grant, a player you probably haven't seen a lot of, Mike, but a tough guy. A one-cut downhill guy, not great elude or anything, but he hits it hard, and he has tremendous speed. Ryan Grant ran around 4.45 coming out. This guy's 4.39, so he can hit it. And the Packers caught a break when he did not play. And this guy, I mean, just look at his numbers. Against Carolina, he rushed 9 for 90 3 weeks ago. He had a game earlier against Denver. He caught 4 passes for 132. They tried to put a linebacker on him, and he just ate him up. He's a good back. He's going to play about 30% of the time. Freeman, the other guy, the Packers saw him. Packers did a good job on him in that game.
Yeah, they did.
Last 4 games, he's got 333 rushing, 212 receiving. He's a dangerous cat.
Now, one of the staples of the Packers defense this year has been Joe Thomas, the inside linebacker, handling running back coverage. He's done it all season. I've talked to him a lot about his process of getting ready for these guys that are sometimes faster than him, although size-wise, he actually stacks up okay against them. Is he a type of linebacker that might be able to stay with these guys, or is that asking for trouble the way you mentioned the Denver game?
It's a very good point, Mike, and it's some of that defensive success will come right down to that matchup. Joe Thomas is playing with a back problem. We know that. He has to play because they have no confidence right now in Blake Martinez.
Correct.
Right? It's a big matchup, and I don't know how Thomas is going to fare against either one of them.
I think they're going to give him a shot to try and see how it goes. I don't know what – I mean, I guess you would put a safety on him, right, if you didn't want a linebacker?
Yeah. You play more dime.
Play more dime.
But they're going to run against that dime, obviously, and even on 3rd and 6 or something, they might run if they see that dime.
Yeah.
So they're a very diverse attack. Any other change on offense? Not really. The only team in the league with 5 offensive linemen to start every game.
One other change. Jacob Tammy's on IR now.
He got hurt early in the Green Bay game.
Oh, it was the Green Bay game that he got hurt. Okay.
Separated shoulder, out for the year. His fourth snap in that game.
What have scouts thought of Austin Hooper, this rookie from Stanford?
They like him, and I like him too. Boy, he made that catch beautifully in his hands on the left side against that Seattle. I mean, he just tremendous hand placement and so fluid. 4.7 flat. He's not a burner, but you can't ignore him.
And then their number two tight end is Levine Toilolo, probably the only guy Julius Peppers will ever look up to on a football field because he's, what, 6'8", 6'7 and a half?
Yeah, yeah.
He's a monster.
He's okay.
Yeah.
Ryan, I mean, everybody's talking about Ryan, and they should. He gets the ball out fast. He's accurate. He's courageous. And he's on point, man.
So before we move on to the defense, from what you saw on tape against Seattle, what did you think of the offense, the way that they were operating?
Well, we need to talk about Julio Jones, right? He's hurting. He's in and out of the lineup. He's taking himself out. He's just not as dominant. And we know how the Packers played last time with Gunter underneath and Dix over the top. So, I mean, he'll be ready to go, but will he get re-injured and will he have to fall out? Probably.
It's a turf toe, right?
Yeah.
So the one question I've been getting all week from people on Twitter or email or whatever is, can they do the same thing, matching him with Gunter, and get away with it? And the one thing that I've kept pointing out with people over and over and over again is one of the reasons why Dez Bryant had more success than Odell Beckham did is because the Cowboys were able to run the football. The Giants could not, which means that they could keep both safeties back and dedicate somebody to shadowing over the top to help Gunter. When the Cowboys ran the ball with Elliott and they couldn't do that, you have to bring one of those safeties into the box, and then you can't guarantee Gunter help over the top on every play. So if Tevin Coleman and Freeman can run the ball similar to the way Dallas did, or at least with some efficacy, then you're not going to be able to give Gunter that type of help against Jones, however healthy he is.
Who would you say is a better offense, Mike, at home, Dallas or Atlanta?
Atlanta.
You know, when you look at those matchups, well, okay. Dallas has got a lot of people, boy. You know, they really do. Atlanta has the edge at quarterback. But, boy. Okay.
I guess I just view this offense, maybe better isn't the right word, but more explosive. You know, they lead the league in gains of 20 yards or more. I think it's 84 they had going into the Seattle game, mm-hmm. which is just absurd. So I guess I would view this Atlanta offense as more explosive than Dallas, whereas Dallas's is more... It's going to wear you down because of the style they play with Elliott punching you in the mouth.
All right, one word on their O-line. They did a nice job against Seattle. They had the benefit of the noise, and which they'll have this week. Jake Matthews gave a bunch of pressures up in that Seattle game.
Yeah, he did not look very good.
He can handle speed, Mike, but I think he struggles against power.
Okay.
Mac's a really good center. Schrader's an improving right tackle. I thought he was all right in that Seattle game. And the guards are okay. They're veteran. They're together. They work well to the second level. I mean, they're in that zone scheme. They're pretty efficient, and you got to give them credit. The only other real change would be Taylor Gabriel, who made his first big play of the season against Dimitri Goodson.
For the touchdown.
On the post.
Deep throw down the middle.
47 yards. Gabriel's taking on more of a role. He's a pretty good player. He's 5'7 and a half.
From Abilene Christian, right?
Is he? You got it.
Yeah. Speedster.
Very.
He can fly.
All right. Now let's go to the D.
Okay.
This is Dan Quinn's cover 3 D. 4-3 under. All right. They suffered a blow. They lost Adrian Claiborne. There's two scouts and one assistant coach for a recent Falcon opponent told me Tuesday that Claiborne is their second, they would consider him their second best pass rusher after Vic Beasley. That is a major blow. Now, he's not a great player, okay, and their pass rush was not great to start with. But still, Claiborne's a real tough guy, the former Buccaneer. He really brings it snap after snap, and he's out. And so they have problems. What are they going to do? Everybody else will have to play more snaps, including 36-year-old Dwight Freeney. Brooks Reed, Tyson Jackson's a 5 technique. I don't see him really figuring in this game. And Courtney Upshaw, the old Raven linebacker, he's going to have to move from inside to outside. Yep. Okay, so in Game 9, the week after the Packer game, Desmond Trufant, you could argue he's their most valuable player on defense to that point. He suffered a season-ending shoulder injury, it was.
Okay.
Yep. Jalen Collins, a second-round pick in 2015. He was inactive for the Packer game, not because of injury. He was in some kind of the doghouse for some reason. Jalen Collins becomes the starter. They have to go with him. He's 6'1.5". He ran pretty good, 4.49, not great, but okay. So he's now in the lineup. Difference of opinion on the guy. Some think he lacks instincts. He can be attacked. Others don't think he's a real weak link. But in any event, he's not Desmond Trufant. Robert Alford, who had a ton of penalties first half of the season, he's become the nominal number one. I mean, he's okay. He's okay. He's not Darius Slay or anything like that. All right, the nickelback is Brian Poole, a free agent. I think he's a free agent. Rookie. Yeah, he's a free agent.
Florida?
Rookie. Yeah. You know, Poole, he's on the short side, barely 5'10", ran 4-5 flat, played that Packer game. At least he's been on the field 75% of the time.
Yeah.
He knows the defense. This is Dan Quinn, just like the Seahawks, that cover three stuff, so it doesn't put a lot of pressure on their coverage people. So that's what they're going to line up with against the Packers. It's not very appealing.
No, it's not. And I think that both Aaron Rodgers and Matt Ryan can look at the opposing secondaries and think that there are yards to be had and completions to be made.
Any other changes? The guy from Minnesota, Rashid Hageman, the DT, he didn't play the first Packer game. He stands up tall right away, shows his numbers, but he does have a tremendous amount of ability, and that's what got him drafted where he was. He could make a play. Who else could make a play? Jonathan Babineau. I've always liked the guy.
I thought he played pretty well against Seattle.
Did you?
I thought he did, yeah. He was active.
Mm-hmm.
Even when he wasn't necessarily making a tackle, he was interjecting into the backfield in order to disrupt the play, and I thought he actually had a pretty good game. Now, granted, we all have talked about how bad Seattle's offensive line is, so that was certainly part of it. But I thought Babineau played well, and I thought Brooks Reed played well.
Mm-hmm. Grady Jarrett's decent also, Mike. He's a quick guy. I think the Packers can run at Jarrett, but he's quick and he can make a play. All right, the linebackers. That's going to be Deion Jones and Minnesota rookie Devondre Campbell playing every snap. Boy, scouts are really high on Jones.
Really?
Really high.
I saw some consideration for defensive rookie of the year on Twitter.
Yeah. This scout said that one guy said that Beasley's their MVP, Jones is number two.
Okay.
And Keanu Neal is number three. And he said after that, there's really nobody.
Okay.
So Jones is fast. Campbell's fast and active, too. I remember talking to him at the combine. Late round pick, I think. He's athletic. He's got snap in his body. He's an impressive guy. Now, his instincts are, you know, not there yet by any means, but he's okay.
One of the things that jumped out to me when I watched the tape of that Seattle game yesterday was that I thought that on that track indoors that the team's speed of the defense was really impressive. However, despite the fact that they were bolting to wherever they were going, whatever direction it was, I thought there were a number of missed tackles. And so I think that even though they were getting there quickly, they weren't necessarily wrapping up. You saw that a lot of times on some of the quick short throws from Wilson to his receivers where somebody would try and make a quick tackle within a yard or two of the line of scrimmage, and you know, whether it was Alford or Collins or whatever, they would break free and pick up more yards. And even some of the D linemen, when they would break into the backfield against Rawls or whoever it was, I didn't necessarily think they were great tacklers, but I did think they played very fast.
Okay. Richard Smith coordinates that defense for Quinn and makes the calls. His blitz percentage is, he blitzed 12.5% against Green Bay. And his season percentage, I think, is 16.5, according to Sport Radar, which second to last in the league behind the Bears.
But, oh, okay. I would have guessed Dallas.
Yeah, they're a little bit more, I guess. So they're not going to blitz. They're going to sit there and try to make Green Bay go the distance, meanwhile taking time off the clock from the Atlanta offense. All right, the kicker, Matt Bryant's darn good. The punter, kickoff guy, Bosher, he's fine. Eric Weems is a tough guy returner. He had a big one in that Packer playoff game in 2010, I believe it was. Maybe it was a regular season game that year. He's okay. So that's the Falcons.
One quick question about Keanu Neal. He's their rookie, their first-round pick, big hitter. We talked a lot about some of the deficiencies he had early in the season prior to that Week 8 game. What have scouts seen or not seen in terms of improvement from him since then?
Just improvement in reactions. I asked one guy that very question, and he just thought he was a better player. He described him as an enforcer, a lot better in the box, but his reaction time has picked up. He's a smart guy.
Can he still be beaten in coverage the way
yes.
he was having problems early in the year?
You do not want to match him up. Now, when they do match up, they got Ricardo Allen. He's short, 5'9.5". Is he from – yeah, he's from Purdue. He's okay. Allen's not bad. And I thought he stuck his nose in there in some hits, too, in that Seattle tape. But he's okay. So it's not a very good secondary. It's not a very good pass rush. And without their number two guy, it's a defense that can be had.
Definitely. I think it's going to be a high-scoring game.
Everybody thinks that. What's the over-under, Mike? I'm not into that, really. But
60.5. I read in Peter King's MMQB that it's the highest over-under for a championship game or Super Bowl in the modern era, I think he said.
Okay.
So 30.25 points for each team. So there you go.
Okay.
Last time it was 33-32. We'll have to see what it is this time around on Sunday.
Okay, so last week, Mike, you were involved in a story with, well, first of all, Geronimo Allison was picked up on a drug charge. And then Sam Shields had been arrested in October. And then Darren Perry, the Packers safeties coach, also was involved in a legal matter. Why don't you explain that?
Yeah, it was definitely an interesting week for the Packers in terms of off-the-field goings-on. On Tuesday, as you mentioned, I broke the story about Geronimo Allison and his possession of marijuana charge. And then on Friday, Thursday or Friday, I can't remember, the news about Shields comes out that he faces drug charges, and then that Darren Perry had a drunken driving charge, and for Perry it was at least his fourth drunken driving situation. So it was just a weird, weird week for the Packers. You know, the Shields thing, the possession of marijuana, obviously it's a crime, obviously it's a banned substance like we talked about, but the fact that, you know, this is Allison, this is Shields, we've seen Dayton Jones, we've seen Pinnell with substance abuse, it goes to show you that a lot of these guys in the league are doing this, whether it's against the rules or not. To me, as just a human, the Perry thing is more concerning to me. You know, four drunken driving issues dating back to, I think it was 2000. The first one came when he was with the Saints, and I read an article about it online. ABC News affiliate down there talked about there was like a hit and run involved, and it was just a messy situation. Then he had two more when he was coaching the Steelers DBs in 06 or 08. I can't remember. Whatever his last year was in Pittsburgh. And then this one, you know, so it was just a really weird scenario. I mean, you've covered this team a long time. Have assistants been had issues with, you know, DUIs or drunken driving over the years? I know, you know, players are different, but coaches.
A DUI for a coach, huh?
Yeah.
It's a lot of years. I think so, but I can't remember pinpoint it.
Okay. Were you surprised that Perry was there to coach on Sunday? I mean, four times to me suggests there might be an actual issue there.
Yeah. Was I surprised? No.
I wasn't either.
Yeah.
I'll be interested to see, because coaches can get suspended too by the league, right?
Yeah.
I'd be interested to see if he would have any repercussions from this. And he's a guy, obviously, that has been mentioned, at least in different circles, of a guy that could move up, you know, based on the job he's done here. So it'll be interesting to see how that affects him moving forward.
He's been here 8 years.
He's done a good job.
Yeah.
With his on-field stuff, no doubt about it. Bringing along Clinton Dix, and as we mentioned earlier, Burnett has had, you know, perhaps the best season of his career. So just a strange week for the Packers. Should we take a look at a couple questions here to close this out?
Sure.
Okay. All right, so we got a few questions this week, and one of them was a little tongue-in-cheek comment from your old colleague and my friend here, Tyler Dunn. He says, first time, long time, can I finally delete T.G. Shepherd and Gordon Lightfoot from my iTunes playlist?
Well,
is this a jab at you, Bob?
We had dinner with Tyler in Dallas, didn't we, Mike?
Yeah, we did.
Over at, what was the name of the place? Tyler's drove us there.
Sweetgrass? No, lemongrass? Something with grass in the title,
wasn't it? Sweet, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Some steakhouse.
Yeah.
And we tried to get into the first place, and that was jammed.
Yes.
Okay. So, Tyler, no, you cannot. I think it was Only One You by TG, Mr. Shepherd. Maybe it was Slow Burn. I don't know. But he's got so many hits. So, Tyler, you're going to listen to that forever. And as far as Gordon Lightfoot, that's going to be on your tombstone that you did not know anything about the Edmund Fitzgerald.
I didn't either.
Sorry, pal.
Oh, man. Okay, let's see what else we've got here for questions. This question comes from Frank Miller. Frank wants to know, will outside linebacker Jayron Elliott be available, club or no club? Well, Elliott was inactive. He's got that broken hand. He'd been wearing a club, and he'd actually played with the club, mostly on special teams. I don't think he played from scrimmage with it. I was actually kind of surprised that he was inactive because he had played with the club. I don't know if it was a setback or they just didn't necessarily think that, you know, he was giving him enough on special teams without the ability to rip and grab. I think he's going to play this week. I think he's going to be out there. And I don't know if he's going to have to wear the full club, but I think it might be a smaller kind of version in the way that Nick Perry's has decreased in size since the Texans game when he broke his hand. Without him, I mean, the big linebacker that they've had is Jordan Tripp, this guy that they signed off the street, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, off the street, and he's basically special teams only. He's the closest thing they've got to Elliott in terms of the size and speed and, you know, measurements there.
If Thomas or Ryan went down, would they go to Martinez or Tripp?
At inside linebacker?
Yeah.
Martinez.
Over Jordy?
Yeah, I like a week and a half ago, I overheard Tripp in the locker room talking to Morgan Burnett, and he's been here what, a month?
Yeah.
So about a week and a half ago, he was going, you know, I think I'm finally starting to get this defense down. He said, it took me a really long time, but I think I've finally gotten enough reps to where I understand this defense. So that kind of tells you where he's at in terms of his development. So I think they'd play Martinez.
Boy, a guy like Tripp, huh? Shot for a Super Bowl ring. Isn't that something?
Yep.
Herb Waters, I mean, yeah. Okay.
Let's see. This question comes from Mad City Architect. Great name. Wants to know, can the Packers get the run going against the Falcons? Ripkowski ran well in the first meeting.
Yes. Grady Jarrett's an undersized nose. Babineau is a guy who wants to fly upfield. You can run at him. Freeney's undersized. Beasley's undersized. Brooke Reed, he's a tough guy. But Claiborne was really a pillar in their run defense. He's gone, in addition to being a good rusher. I think that's a very good point, and I think the Packers can do a lot of damage on the ground.
All right, and the last one we'll take comes from Hans Voss. Since the last Falcons game, has Ladarius Gunter's play improved, regressed, or stayed about the same? I actually think he's gotten a little bit better since then because I think he's more accustomed to this number one role. I just think the level of competition he's had to face and been matched up against has been greater than what the Packers had down the stretch. I just think that he's had a rough stretch of games here. That doesn't necessarily mean he's, you know, a bad player or playing ridiculously poorly. I just think he's over his head in what they're asking him to do at certain times. But I do think he's developed a lot since the beginning of the season, and whether or not that's continued from week 8, I say yes.
Mm-hmm.
So we've reached our time limit. We've overstayed our welcome. What do we got on the way out, Bob? Because I can't remember that artist or the song.
Well, you should, Mike. It'll be on your, what do you call it now?
Well, it's on iTunes, so it's on my phone by default.
Nice. Mr. Buddy Jewell.
Never to be played again.
Bagel operator, house operator in Nashville. Sweet Southern Comfort. And I won't be tearing up on this one, okay, Mike?
All right, sounds good. We will see you guys next week.
From Carolina down to Georgia, smell the jasmine.